shaking her head in exasperation and telling the long-suffering cafe owners that her kids were, to use her favourite phrase, total rotters. I'd been in jail too long because even as I thought about it, I felt a tiny zap of warmth. It was a facsimile of a family, but it was what I had. Since the letter, we have slotted back into our old relationship with a strange ease. I phoned him 2 days after I read it, letting him panic a little bit. We have talked at every opportunity since. I have been magnanimous. He has been racked with guilt and had come up with a plan to move me into his flat and nurse me back to life, as though I had been marooned on a leper colony for months and not in jail because he accused me of murdering his ghastly fiancée. I firmly shut that down. I wanted to be in my familiar place as I planned for my next move, and having Jimmy bring me cups of tea would hamper that somewhat. There would be time for cohabitation later, when we could live in a house big enough to spend a pleasurable amount of time away from each other. Thorpe was also fielding calls from the media, especially from the tabloids, who had done a 180-degree turn on my case with such speed that reporters must have sprained muscles. The narrative of the Morton murderer was about to be replaced by something equally terrible, at least in my mind. I idly speculated about my new moniker. If I'd had access to a betting shop, I'd have put money on Full of Grace, being at least one headline used upon my release, complete with an image of me reading out a statement. Composed, long-suffering, dignified. The playbook was too easy. I wouldn't speak to any of them immediately, of course. I wasn't some desperate novice who didn't understand how this stuff worked and took the first check she could. My narrative would be my own. Besides, press attention would wait until I revealed myself not only to be an innocent victim, but also a grieving daughter. That's high-class human interest, the kind that guarantees your name will be known for decades to come. Once the dust has settled a little, I'll make some initial overtures to Thorpe regarding my father and his estate. Of course, I won't put it as bluntly as that. I'll just say that this experience has made me reassess my life and explain that I want to explore the connection with that side of my family. It's too late to know my father, I'll say, as I dab my eyes with a tissue, but I want to know where I come from and who he was. There is nobody else left in that family except Lara, and Lara isn't even a blood relative. She's an estranged wife, and one that I graciously spared at that. I knew from the moment I decided not to kill her that she would be my gateway. I will approach her with such charm and grace, ha, that she will be on my side from the start. Two women wronged by Artemis men, both of us trying to lead lives away from their heavy presence. Women supporting women, that's what we like to see. Perhaps we'll even become friends, though a connection solely made because we were both damaged by brothers seems like an unhealthy foundation for lifelong kinship. But then again, forging a connection over hatred can be stronger than anything else. Stronger than bonding over a love of ceramics or a passion for avant-garde opera. We would have a much tougher bond. The money is important, but the goal was always the annihilation of the family. But that didn't mean I would be content with nothing. And if she wouldn't play ball, there were other options. She'd been spared, but that was always negotiable. And now you're up to date. I've spent a further 8 days in Limehouse and I have one more to go. Today I was told by a bored-looking guard I'd not seen before, the turnover of staff is high, probably because who in their right mind wants to wrangle a bunch of angry women for 12 hours a day for minimum wage when you could work in a Starbucks and wrangle slightly less angry women but also get free lattes? That I should expect to be released at 3 p.m. tomorrow on the dot. Since the guard had no care for my privacy, she told me this in front of Kelly, who has now insisted on having a party of sorts for me tonight, in the games room. As part of the preparation, she made me go to her friend Dion's cell to have my makeup done, something I hotly protested but was bounced into anyway. I finished this from my cell, unable to sleep. I faintly remember this excitement from childhood, when Marie would creep across the room on Christmas Eve with a stocking for me. Like all children, I would try and stay awake, waiting for Santa to bring me the loot. Unlike most children, I succeeded and realised the con early. It didn't faze me much. I still got the presents, despite the subterfuge. Tomorrow I will spend the morning readying myself, staying calm and conserving my energy. But tonight I'm all over the place, thoughts running wild, adrenaline surging. As I thought, my makeup was an experience I won't be repeating. I emerged from Dion's cell after an intense 20 minutes with a face that vaguely resembled a blow-up sex doll and hair that had been backcombed within an inch of its life. The only excuse I have for allowing it is that I was high on the fumes of my freedom and knew that there could be no photographs of the night in question. Despite my complete success in making precisely no friends during my stay, a fair few women turned up to the party, lured by the distraction and the promise of soft drinks and cake. There was no cake, as it turned out. But it limped on for 45 minutes anyway, and Kelly told everyone how much she'd miss me, and I took care not to return the compliment. I doubt it drove the message home. Kelly has the hide of a knock-off Birkin bag. When I retreated back to my cell, I got into bed pretending to be asleep by 8:30 p.m. I'm writing this under the covers. Even with mere hours to go until I leave, I can't risk encouraging Kelly to attempt one last deep and meaningful. Tomorrow morning, I shall pack up my meagre possessions and get ready to re-enter the world, a world which will be very different for me from now on. Chapter 15. I dreamt about my mother last night. It wasn't a nice dream. I don't often have nice dreams. I never have horrific nightmares either. Normally, I just get transported back to difficult or sad moments in my life and relive them until I wake up. I suppose I don't possess a huge amount of imagination, but I respect my practical brain for not diverting me with nighttime adventures. I won't bore you with the memory my sleeping mind dredged up, but I woke up missing Marie more intensely than I had in years and feeling further away from her than usual. Every plan and every murder kept me feeling connected to her, as though she was right beside me, powering me on. But she's not in here with me. Not that I blame her. This is not a place for lingering souls. A ghost would take one look at Limehouse and apparate through a wall immediately. If Marie is hovering around, stuck between this world and another, I hope she's haunting Fortnum and Mason or flitting around Harvey Nichols rearranging the mannequins. I don't believe all that nonsense, by the way. There are no ghosts stalking these corridors, and my mother was not whispering in the wind while I avenged her. But her memory was fresh while my rage was stoked, and now that it's all over, I find myself thinking of her less. Her face is blurring and fading. Perhaps a therapist would call that closure. I suppose killing people and getting away with it is a kind of closure, but possibly not one that a medical professional can recommend in good conscience. I have to explain how Simon died. I know that the final death is normally the icing on the cake in novels, the biggest and most dramatic. That's partly why I've been putting off writing it all down, because this is not a novel. I didn't arrange it so that his death would be the most shocking. I didn't push him out of a hot air balloon or throw him off Waterloo Bridge at sunset. Perhaps I should have tried for a plan like that, just for the added dramatic flair, but I've never been one for needless stunts. Once the final important member of Simon's family had been dispatched, my need for urgency slackened. Like a marathon runner who knows there's only 1 mile to go, I decided to enjoy the route for a little bit. That meant scoping out how Simon was doing. And given the circumstances, Bryony's funeral felt like the best place to observe him. It was a risky one to try and attend, and I'd mulled it over for several days before deciding that there would be enough weeping women my age there for me to fit in okay. If there was ever a time to see Simon's grief raw and up close, it was there. I'd just have to make sure I looked the part. The day before the funeral, I raided the company clothing cupboard, which held clothes and accessories that were ready to be loaned out to important clients for events. The array of stuff we kept in this dingy space was eye-watering. Designer shoes stuffed on top of each other, bags which cost upwards of $2,000 forlornly lying on the floor. Above them were sequined dresses and colourful jumpsuits on a rack, next to a sign which said, "The higher the heel, the closer to God." If eyeballs were capable of bleeding, the signs I had to see in this office every day would be the main trigger. I knew how to dress for this kind of event. I'd spent my adulthood learning how to blend in no matter the situation. At work, that means wearing clothes which walk the line of dull but avoid active frump. In the wider world, it means regular trips to Zara, like every other woman my age, to acquire the regulation armour of jeans, oversized jumpers and chunky boots. But in a crowd of uber-wealthy Instagram airheads, fitting in meant something else entirely. These girls didn't just spend obscene amounts of money on clothes. Anyone rich can do that. Walk down Bond Street and laugh at the idiots who think shearling-lined Gucci loafers and fur-trimmed puffer jackets are the epitome of style, and you'll see what I mean. No, these women were beady-eyed and specific about what they wore, and woe betide you if you got it wrong. It wouldn't be enough just to have any Prada bag. It would have to be the one that a certain Italian Instagram star was gifted 3 months prior to it hitting the shops. I didn't care about their judgment, of course, but I didn't want to raise eyebrows or provoke any challenge about my presence. So I purloined a brand new burgundy silk trouser suit made by an up-and-coming Italian designer I knew Vogue were currently championing, and boosted a snakeskin Celine clutch bag whose absence, if noticed, would certainly get me fired. For shoes, I went with a pair of yellow leather mules and spent the rest of the day fervently hoping that Bryony's funeral wouldn't be one where everybody wore solemn black. The actual burial was a private event, and I didn't even allow myself to entertain gatecrashing that. But the service of remembrance was a free-for-all, trailed in the Evening Standard as though it was the opening of a new bar. Nothing like a sombre event mourning the loss of a young woman for some pap shots. And maybe a performative sob on camera for your followers to see at the end of the day. The venue was a huge old church off the Marylebone Road, but there was nothing holy about this space. Years ago, it had been turned into a private member space which could be rented out for tens of thousands of pounds and had seen everything from minor celebrity weddings to the 21st birthday of a Ukrainian oligarch's daughter, which had to be shut down after the organisers allowed her to ride into the event on a horse spray-painted a pale blush colour. Even our equine friends cannot escape the proliferation of millennial pink. I walked into the church sandwiched by throngs of other people, their dark glasses reflecting other dark glasses, their diamonds glinting in the sun and casting jewel-shaped shadows on the stone floor. The service was interminable. 90 minutes of readings, songs, and even a slideshow of Bryony's most memorable moments, if a bunch of fucking selfies can count as memories. The true low moment was when a very skinny girl wearing a transparent shift dress displaying her neon underwear walked up to the lectern and began to read an excerpt from Bryony's favourite book, The Secret. The quivering vocal fry almost sent me over the edge, not helped by the next reading, the poem I Carry Your Heart With Me, I Carry It In My Heart by E.E. Cummings, the patron saint of girls who want to appear to be deep but don't know any other poets. Thankfully, it wrapped up pretty quickly after that. A gospel choir sang Stand By Me beautifully as weeping mourners hugged each other. Not a lot of actual tears, I noticed. Carefully arranged expressions of sadness. Dry faces. Mainly I was looking for Simon. The compere, clearly not the right word for such a solemn occasion, but the man was wearing a suit with gold braiding and looked like a bingo caller, so I'm sticking with it. Announced at the start of the ceremony that if anyone felt overwhelmed that they should feel free to go out into the garden for some air. As a result, there was a stream of people heading for the door throughout the ceremony, only to come back wafting tobacco down the aisle. The constant back and forth meant that Simon was visible only half the time. I got a good view of him during the playing of an Adele song, as he heaved his shoulders and grabbed the neck of a young man sitting next to him in a fairly aggressive way which made the other man look faintly uncomfortable. It's a huge cliché for sure, but grief is not good for the skin. He really did look 10 years older. I can only see Simon in a detached way. There is no true human link between us. But it nearly made me feel a sliver of sympathy for him. Then again, seeing him fall apart over the loss of a loved one also provoked a new sense of fury. Men often say they are feminists only when they have a daughter of their own and are forced to see women as equal human beings. Simon could only experience sadness and vulnerability when someone he loved had been taken from him. My mother died, and he knew I had been left alone in the world. For me, there was nothing. He had the luxury to pick and choose who he held close. Well, now he didn't. A week later, I was sitting at home reading the papers while picking at a Danish pastry. One a week, a stupid rule I initiated to test my limits of self-denial. I opened the Saturday supplements to find a diary item about Simon, which spoke of worries from friends about his mental health. Ah, mental health. The get-out clause for all bad behaviour. The friends were unnamed, of course, but the quotes were revealing. Simon was paranoid and reclusive, muttering about enemies who were out to get him. Not wrong, but it made him sound satisfyingly unhinged. Apparently he kept telling people that his daughter had definitely been murdered, despite the police assurances that they were satisfied it had been a tragic accident. How awful it must be to know in your bones that those around you were being picked off one by one and to realise that you must therefore be next. Even worse, it seemed like nobody was listening to him. A terrible thing for a powerful white man to experience. I hadn't thought far enough ahead to really savour the prospect that Simon would begin to fear for his own safety. All along, I had only concentrated on the sadness he would face when I killed his loved ones. This panicked paranoia was an added bonus. It made me wonder whether his innate selfishness meant that this fear was actually stronger than any grief he felt. Exploring it further, I decided that it was. A man like my father would feel the loss of his family, but he'd be absolutely shaken by the idea that he might be in danger. A wife and daughter could be replaced. He would hardly be the first 50-something man to start another family in middle age. but his sense of safety was being tested for the first time. I felt so cheered by this realization that I ate a second pastry in celebration. At the time, I thought that this moment in my life was glorious. Now I look back and see only how terrible it was all about to get. I had scored 6 names off my little list, 6 down, 1 to go. The pressure had lifted and I began to cultivate some form of a life. I upped my running, took time to read a few of the books I'd been piling up on my bedside table, and even went on a few dates. Nothing much was doing in that department, because really, who wants to carry on seeing a man who has vintage Playboy posters in his living room? People think that buying something and calling it vintage puts them a cut above, but old Playboys are still wank mags, just in faded colour, and men who order dirty martinis are not men who'll be Playboying anywhere near me. Anyway, the dates were not the highlight of that period. The wonderful thing was the feeling of a load lifting. I am stubborn. It's good to admit one's flaws. And that stubbornness meant that a plan I conceived as a child was one I felt sworn to carry out well into adulthood, to the detriment of everything else. Even if I hadn't decided that revenge was a path I had to charge down, I know my life would have been unthinkably different. Unthinkable mainly because to really consider what it could have been like is painful. It feels a little weak to admit that, but it's true nonetheless. As a result, I've never thought about it much. I've never thought about the career I could have had. I wanted to be a journalist at one point, which I imagine would have ultimately meant a similar life to the one I have now, deceit and drinking. I've never thought about the possibility that Jimmy and I could have built a life together without me holding him at arm's length while I completed my own private quest. I've never thought about how deliberately small I'd made my life, always filled with anger directed at people who never thought of me at all. Even though I knew this, the anger burned bright. It bubbled out of me every time I walked past Simon's enormous gated house, and I did it a lot as a teenager, it being just 15 minutes and a whole world away from the Latimer Enclave. Every time I saw a Google alert tell me that Bryony was in the Daily Mail sidebar of shame. Every time Janine threw a charity gala and one of the society pages featured it. Every time they were projected into my world, I felt a new burst of it, like another tendril had suddenly sprung and uncoiled. But during this interlude, I felt the anger wilt. Not entirely, you understand. I wasn't suddenly going to call it quits and walk away. But Caro had just arrived on the scene, and I was dealing with that spiteful spanner in the works. The drain on my focus made me notice I was spending a lot less time thinking about the Artemis clan. Perhaps that's rubbing it in since there was no clan to speak of anymore. And more time thinking about the wider world and what I might do in it. The vague plan I'd always carried in my head was one which looked something like this. Kill my family. Make a claim on said family fortunes. This was pretty blurry in my mind. I didn't want the whole toxic empire. Just a few million quid to be able to live life in any way I chose. Get together with Jimmy. Obviously this was almost stymied by Caro, but her helpful demise and my wrongful conviction meant that this was very much back on the cards. Buy a house, travel, make some friends, adopt a dog. Get away with all of the above. It was the scheme of a child, a lofty and ridiculous one with no specifics or safety nets tacked on. The money was an added extra that I increasingly believed was in reach. But the plan, which formed when I didn't understand the wealth just beyond my fingertips, was all about revenge. I kept it stoked, even when there were moments where I admitted to myself that it was a damaging obsession. But somehow I'd followed it fairly faithfully. Grandparents, a breeze. Andrew, painful but well executed. Lee, pfft. Janine and Bryony, a triumph. And now I was tentatively sure I'd be able to follow it to completion. That feeling, after years of adrenaline, was intoxicating. So instead of actually knuckling down and finishing it all, I spent hours on estate agent websites looking at houses. St. John's Wood was too gaudy, full of beautiful houses lived in by greasy people who thought that chrome banisters were the height of elegance. Primrose Hill was exactly the same, only the people who lived there bought expensive vintage knick-knacks and thought they were better than chrome. Kensington is a terrible place altogether and I would never consider living in Clapham or Dulwich or anywhere else buggies outnumber adults. It took me 3 days to settle on Bloomsbury for my fantasy new home, and a further 2 days of teaching myself how to do lino cuts before I realised how fucking slack I'd become. I'd fallen into the danger zone of complacency, and I was gloriously wallowing in it, stretching out and wiggling my toes. I gave myself a stern talking to, deleted dating apps, packed away books, nail varnishes, and anything else which might entice me into distraction, and cleaned my flat until it was all in order. Then I stuck an A3 piece of paper up on my bedroom wall and got back to it. An hour later, I had written down 10 ideas and they were all ridiculous. This part of the plan suddenly felt like the most grueling, when I always thought it would be the best bit. Kill the boring Z-list members of the family to get to Simon. Race through the starters to get to the main course. But instead, I just felt like I was trudging on. So I put on my running kit and set off for Hampstead, taking a route I knew like the back of my hand, and I ended up outside the Artemis gates hoping for inspiration. The road was quiet, except for a private security contractor in a yellow bib who wandered past me smoking a cigarette. He barely glanced at me, which confirmed my long-held suspicion that private guards are just there to give a false sense of security to paranoid rich people, but could no more disarm a burglar than your grandmother could. Depending on the grandmother, she might actually have a better chance. I stood just beyond the reach of the CCTV camera attached to the gate and looked up at the house, set back from the road and surrounded by a garden which wrapped around the property. The blinds were drawn on every window, shutting the world out. The front door, partially obscured by an enormous Range Rover, was firmly shut. It wasn't just a house in mourning. The homes of the ultra-wealthy often look as though they are uninhabited, which a lot of the time they are. When you've got four or five houses, you're not in one place very much. If Simon decided to flee to his Barbadian bolt hole or spend months walking around the Monaco penthouse wailing for Janine, I'd be in trouble. That last option was less likely, since he didn't seem to have spent too much time grieving for his wife, and I can't imagine wanting to hang around the place where she came to a fairly grotesque end. But then the gates whirred into motion, and a soft-top sports car hove into view, being driven by a young guy who I guessed was an assistant. That must mean Simon was at home, and that gave me some hope. Back at home, I crossed off all the plans I'd held in my head for him over the years. Some of them were silly, fanciful, unworkable. An early plan to pose as cabin crew on his private plane made me particularly embarrassed. How long would I have to train to get to that point? Stupid Grace. Some were more realistic, and I didn't disregard the idea to send a condolence parcel to his office, which might just happen to contain a substance which just potentially might kill him within seconds. But mainly I felt a sinking feeling, that I'd done it all wrong, that I should have killed him before the rest of his terrible family. I'd made him paranoid and prone to hide away. In my excitement and my insistence on build-up, I'd made the final target almost impossible to reach. My gloom infected my confidence and made me pull back from every partial plan I had laid out. Then matters were made infinitely worse when Jimmy got engaged to Caro, darkening my mood and causing me to wake up in the night, pulling at the skin at my neck, breathing heavily, sweating through my t-shirt. I felt a looming sense of doom, as if things were rushing ahead of me, already out of my grasp. I could not get a handle on anything. And I was sadly, horribly right. Did you look back to the beginning of this text and note that I killed six members of my family? Did you see that we seem to have already reached this magic number? Well, there are no prizes for such eagle eyes. Don't be smug or think me too much of a fool. I have already spent months dealing with my failure, trying to shake off the feeling that it was all for nothing. For those with a slower cognitive process, I will spell it out. I did not kill Simon Artemis. My one aim in life, and I will never get to achieve it. And why not? Because he's dead. Dead, but from a terrible accident and not by my hand. I'd rather he lived another 50 years in ignominy and sadness than to die by fucking accident. What a cruel joke. 3 days after I was arrested for the murder of Caro Morton, Simon was reported missing by the Times newspaper. It wasn't front page news at first, taking up half of page 3. My initial arrest only made page 6. But the next day, his face was on the front of every paper. Why would it not be? The story had everything. Money, power, death, scandal, and an intriguing mystery. The media revisited their reporting on the tragic year in the Artemis family. Lee, whose death had been hushed up somewhat successfully at the time, was outed as a sexual deviant. A tabloid reporter managed to get into Janine's empty apartment and take photos of the sauna, somberly accompanied by a caption which read, "Burned alive. Did Simon take his own life after tragic wife's gruesome death?" Before there was any real certainty that he was dead, friends of Bryony used the story as an excuse to post photos of her with the hashtag reunited in heaven. If heaven welcomed in sleazy moguls and spiteful posers, then something had gone horribly wrong in Elysium's HR department. Simon had disappeared at sea. This makes him sound like an ancient mariner when in reality he'd started off his speedboat while drunk, despite warnings from the crew. He'd fled to his villa in Saint-Tropez, apparently. I didn't even know he had a house there, given that it's just around the corner from Monaco, but perhaps Janine wanted a country house for much-needed rest. The rich are slippery. None of these properties are ever in the name of millionaires. That's what anonymous offshore trusts are for. An assistant went with him, out of concern that he might do himself harm, which was pretty prescient as it happened. According to the assistant, Simon was driving too fast, pushing the boat up onto its side. Alarmed, the assistant went to take control, and as he pushed past him, my sozzled father tumbled over the edge. The boat was travelling fast, and the assistant took a while to figure out how to get it under control. By the time he'd managed to slow it down and turn back, Simon was under the waves. The other man circled around for 30 minutes, searching in vain for any sign of his employer before returning to the yacht to call for help. The Coast Guard was called and a search took place, but the dark sky and the expanse of water proved too much, and Simon Artemis was presumed dead. Presumed dead just means dead, doesn't it? They hadn't found his bloated corpse nibbled on by sea creatures, but perhaps it was only a matter of time. Or maybe his body sank to the bottom, quickly disintegrating, never to reemerge. It all amounted to the same thing, and as I write this, the authorities have yet to find any trace of him. Not even a monogrammed cufflink remains. He is gone. He never got to know what I had done. I wept. I wept for 2 full days. The sorrow I felt was worse than when my mother died. Not for Simon, but for all I had pinned on killing him myself. That it would make my life mean something. I would avenge Marie and prove that I could rise above my circumstances. I would make things fair. Now all I had for my troubles was the knowledge that I successfully killed some pensioners, drowned a nice boy who wanted to help amphibians, enticed my uncle into a deathly sex club, and bumped off 2 spoilt women the world would never miss. Not quite the glorious victory I had envisaged for myself. I didn't even have the opportunity to drink wine from the bottle and walk around my flat listening to The Cure in the bowels of sorrow. No such fun. I was charged with the murder of Caro Morton and arraigned. That I now had to face a trial for a murder I didn't commit felt like a surreal joke. I had been bested by the universe, and if you believed in karma, which I do not, given that it's for people who set store by crystals, then you would think I'd been whacked in the face with a suitcase full of it. I've mentioned that I fell into some sort of depression early on in my prison stay. Perhaps it's a bit more obvious why it hit me so hard now. I didn't feel as though there was any point in bothering to fight the case because I didn't know what kind of life was now on offer to me that would be worth raising my hopes again for. I look back and see a shambling, vacant-stared husk of myself. I was being completely pathetic. Happily, the shock lifted. Partly, the routine became less unbearable. You really do become institutionalised at a startling speed. I began to find it less scary and more boring, and as my brain lowered the threat level, I started to think about things other than how to breathe normally when the door's locked at night. That meant taking an interest in my case and waking up to the weakness in it. I'd gone through the trial like a zombie, barely engaging with the process at all, weighed down by my own failures. But I began to see how my verdict could be challenged. That's when I brought in George Thorpe. As with so many parts of British life, if you want to be listened to, taken seriously and treated with respect, employ a posh white man to speak on your behalf. Even better if he's middle-aged. That's the privileged jackpot right there. Thorpe made me see that I didn't have to take a jury decision as final. Grace, jurors are, let us say, not always the type of people we necessarily have to listen to. They are often wrong, largely motivated by their own small personal animuses and have a remarkably basic grasp of actual facts. There are many options open to us, so let's see their verdict as a mere opening offer, shall we? I could have kissed the man, had he not been wearing actual braces under his jacket. The thing that really changed my attitude was reading that Lara had announced that she'd be opening the Artemis Foundation to help migrant children. I enjoyed this immensely. Imagining this to be her final fuck you to a family only slightly less likely to care about the plight of vulnerable minors than the witch who lived in the gingerbread house. But it also panicked me. Just how good was Lara intent on being? If the money was about to be tied up in charitable trusts, I'd have a hard time accessing any of it. It's perhaps not a great endorsement of my character that I was boosted into action by the worry that my money would be given to scared refugees, but we are who we are. I've killed 6 people. There's very little point in panicking about my moral fibre now. I got to work then, any lingering depression fading away remarkably fast. I've even managed to reframe my failures. I didn't get to kill Simon, no point trying to soften that blow, but I did dispatch 6 members of his family in pretty quick succession, causing him fear, confusion, and grief which followed him all the way to his final moments. I comfort myself with the knowledge that he would never have been drunk and manic on a speedboat without my actions, so I did play a vital role in his death, even if I couldn't be there to witness his glorious demise. I don't like boats so much, so perhaps it all worked out for the best in some strange way. I had a good hand, even if it wasn't quite the royal flush I'd hoped for.
Chapter 16. I suppose I should start by introducing myself. Otherwise, this will be even odder for you than it already is. My name is Harry, and I am your brother. Gosh, that sounds silly, doesn't it? Like I'm doing a terrible Darth Vader impression. But nevertheless, it's true. Not the same mother, of course, that would be nonsense. Same father. But that's probably obvious. Sorry, I'm no good at explaining all this. Perhaps I'll just start at the beginning. I didn't find out who my father was until I was 23 years old. Well, that's not quite right, actually. I spent that time with a lovely father. Christopher was a fantastic chap, always ready to drive me to rugby practice, taught me how to shoot when I was barely old enough to hold a gun. He used to come upstairs when Nanny had bathed me and put me in my pajamas. Holding a glass of whiskey, he'd perch on the side of my bed and read me a story every night. He wasn't a fan of modern children's books, preferring Arthur Ransome and John Buchan stories. He had a low, deep voice and used to gesticulate with his hands as he read to me, his drink swilling about so that the ice clinked together. It's a sound I enjoy to this day. My parents had two daughters after me. There was a fairly solid age gap, 5 years between me and Molly, and another two between Molly and Belle. I was always told that it was because they were devoting all their attention to me that they'd waited. That was something I held over my sisters' heads a lot, let me tell you. It's fun having siblings, even with such an age gap. You were an only child, weren't you? I can't imagine not having co-conspirators around all the time. Always someone to gang up on. Always somebody to play with. Mum has always been a nervous sort, really. But a lovely woman, despite it all. She worked before she had me. She was a primary school teacher. But I think what she really wanted to do was raise a family and live in the countryside. I know that's not a fashionable thing to say anymore, but it worked very well for our family. And Dad was happy enough to make that happen. I don't think Mum was strong enough for work. You'd probably think that was ridiculous. I know how tough you are. You probably also think that's ridiculous, since we've never met properly. But I'm right, aren't I? Oh, dash, I've rambled on, haven't I? As I said, I didn't find out who my real father was until I was an adult. I'd graduated from Exeter with a degree in PPE, and I'd made the move to London to work in the city and have some fun. Growing up in Surrey meant that London felt raw and exciting to me. Still does, actually. You were born there, weren't you? I imagine you're jaded about this city, too used to it. Lucky you. Mainly, though, I wanted to make money. We were well off, certainly. But I saw what the other lads had at my school, and I always felt a real desire to get that for myself. Christopher was the director of a mid-sized accountancy firm, and he earned a good-sized whack. It was always enough. Until one day it wasn't. That day was when a boy in my class came over for tea during half-term, when I was about 8, and asked if the driver could take him home later on. Mum smiled and said that she'd get him back safely. But he looked bemused. That's when I knew what I was missing. Funny that. Realising at 8 that you want a driver. I imagine most 8-year-olds want an Xbox. Training to be a stockbroker was gruelling. About 18 months in, I got a phone call one lunchtime when I was shoveling a sandwich into my mouth while trying to speed read that day's figures. It was Mum. Her name is Charlotte, by the way. Everyone in the family calls her Lottie. Dad had had a heart attack, and she was at the Royal Surrey Hospital with my sisters. I hailed a cab on Liverpool Street and told the driver to get me there as fast as possible. But it was too late. He died before I arrived. I know you'll understand how I felt that day, having lost your mother so young. We were all inconsolable. I took 3 days off work to be with my mother and sisters, though Mum took to her bed and refused to speak much during that time. But I had to get back to work and arranged for Granny to come down from York to stay with them. The funeral took place a week later. The church was stuffed full of Christopher's friends, those he'd had from school days at Eton, those he made from work, and everyone in between. The choir sang Jerusalem, and everyone said what a true gent my dad was. Mum took a mild sedative to get through it, and my sisters wept a lot. But it was a proper send-off. A lovely day, despite the sadness. Or at least it was, right up until 5 p.m. The wake was back at our house. We'd had it catered. Mum was evidently not up to laying out a spread. So all there was to do was to go around and accept as many sympathetic words as we could from the people in attendance. Mum had retired to her room half an hour before, and I was trying to speak to as many people as I could. The girls were sitting in the living room with Granny. They looked worn out. It was my duty now. As I extricated myself from a dull man in a grey checked suit who'd worked for Dad and headed for the lav, I felt a tap on my shoulder. It was my Aunt Jean. I call her my aunt, but really she was just my mother's oldest friend. As close as sisters, though, and a fixture of my childhood, though I'd not seen much of her in the last few years. She looked old now, big hollowed-out rings under her eyes, and a weird bony hand which grasped mine. "I am so sorry about dear Christopher," she sniffed. I murmured thanks, and we made some small talk about the day. "He always treated you just like a son. Always. He was a wonderful man." "You'll think me a fool, but I would absolutely not have realised what she'd said there if it hadn't have been for the fact that as soon as the words came out, she flinched, dropped my hand, and her eyes bulged. Just for a second, you understand. But I saw that she'd frightened herself." Jean started to say her goodbyes. She had to go. It was a long drive. I nodded, gave her a hug, and told her that I'd say goodbye to Mum for her. I dived into the downstairs loo and rummaged in my jacket pocket for the packet of fags I'd made sure to keep on me in case I needed a minute to myself that day. I know you do that too, don't you? Not all the time. Not a morning coffee and a cigarette kind of girl. Just sometimes, when you need a break from the world. I borrowed your lighter once, at the pub around the corner from your office. It's a good tactic if you want to spend a second or two looking at someone without them minding, or getting creeped out. I went out the side door and into the kitchen garden, where guests weren't congregating. Crouching over with my back against the wall, I replayed Jean's comment in my mind again and again, a comment made by a sad woman that normally I'd have put down to mild battiness, but she looked so panic-stricken when she'd said it. There was no mistaking that. I think I'm a rational person, Grace. I pride myself on cutting through mumbo-jumbo and quashing any self-denial. So the only sensible conclusion, as painful as it might be, was that somehow Christopher was not my real father. I waited until the last guest had gone, made sure that my sisters were safely ensconced in front of the TV, and headed up the narrow staircase to my mother's bedroom. Was your mother weak, Grace? I imagine she was. I bet she was very similar to mine in many ways. The only difference is that my mother had a husband to protect her from the world, and yours did not. I didn't want to land a harsh blow on her, that day of all days, but I suddenly felt so tired of tiptoeing around her, making sure that she wouldn't face any stress or unpleasantness, as she often called it. I wanted to be blunt for once. And so I was. Lottie wasn't asleep. She was just lying in semi-darkness, a cushion hugged to her, as though it was a sleeping pet. She looked tiny. Her wispy blonde hair spread over the pillows like a child's. I sat down on the other side of the bed and told her that I knew that Christopher wasn't my real dad. No point in letting her have even a tiny opportunity to lie. If I was expecting her to crumple and beg forgiveness, I was wrong. She ducked and weaved with an energy I'd not seen in her before. It was energy I didn't know she had in her, to be honest. It took us 10 minutes to get past the outraged stage, where she couldn't believe that I'd make such an allegation. It was 20 minutes to move on from the weeping and repeated insistence that we couldn't talk about such things today of all days. At the half-an-hour point, Lottie was hugging me, telling me that Christopher was my father, no matter what anyone said. 10 minutes later, she began to tell me the truth. My mother had had a fairly sheltered upbringing in Somerset, with a family who had a nice little ancestral home and a respected name. Not too much money for her, when the first child was a prized son, but she was happy enough. She went to London, aged 20, ostensibly to work at an art gallery off Savile Row, but mainly, she told me, to have an adventure. For my mother, this meant a lot of parties, nightclubs, and jaunts to the south of France with rich pals. I knew she'd lived in London before she'd had me, but I was a little surprised at the freewheeling life she was telling me about now. My mother has worn cardigans and wellies every day of my life. It's still hard to imagine her going to some of the clubs that I frequent in town. She already knew Christopher, she told me, but they were just friends. He was shy, something I knew he had been all his life, and she didn't notice him much when out in a group. One night, at the nightclub Vanessa's, she was sitting in a booth with a group of girlfriends when a waiter brought over a glass of champagne and told her it was from the gentleman at the bar. When she looked over, she saw a dark-haired man in a T-shirt and black trousers staring at her intently. Between quivering breaths, my mother explained that she was intrigued. Most of the men she knew were already facsimiles of their fathers, proper and reserved, looking for the right kind of wife. This man was different. And her girlfriends made a huge fuss about the approach, urging her to go and talk to him. So she did. My anxious mother, who takes to her bed whenever life overwhelms her, walked over to this stranger and struck up a conversation. I don't need to tell you the rest, really, do I, Grace? Because you know. It's not your story, and yet it is. By the time Lottie found out that she was pregnant, this man had moved on. And she wasn't strong like your mother. Terrified by what her parents would think, she carried on working in a state of denial. Until one day, my father turned up at the flat she shared with a couple of friends just off the King's Road and told her that he knew what had happened. I don't know whether he'd guessed or what. Lottie was crying at that point, and I didn't want to push it. But he was very kind and told her that they should get married. That makes me smile to think of. Such an act of Victorian heroism from the old man. It was the 90s, for Christ's sakes. But my grandparents were old-fashioned, and I'm sure would have hated any society gossip. As would my mother, for that matter. There is a section of the British upper class which enjoys scandal, or at least finds it all a hoot. My family, despite our good fortune, weren't quite at that level. She smiled as she remembered her reaction to this proposal, still hugging the cushion to her body. I don't know whether Lottie loved Christopher with a romantic passion back then. Maybe she never did. But they were happy, Grace. Really happy. And that seemed like it might mean more than the fireworks and passion that men are always being told women want. Prince Charles, who seems like a decent guy, got in a whole heap of trouble when he answered a reporter who asked if he was in love with Diana by saying, "Whatever in love means." I didn't know what to do that night. Watching Mum cry was an awful thing. So I hugged her and gave her a sedative that our family doctor had prescribed for her and left her to sleep. The rest of it came out over the next few weeks. I went back to work and travelled back to my mother's house every Friday night, walking the dog for miles with my sisters and making sure Mum ate. She has a tendency to forget when she's anxious. Occasionally, I'd ask a question or two about my dad, and she'd flush and sag. Sometimes she'd answer, sometimes she wouldn't, or couldn't. But I couldn't let it go. I'd look at my sisters and suddenly see the ways in which their features weren't like mine. I'd wonder which bits of me were from my mum and which bits were not. My temper was always a source of conversation in my family. I can explode in a way that nobody else does. Christopher was far too mellow, Lottie far too meek. Now I knew it was given to me by someone else. Breeding matters to me, Grace. Not in some stuffy blue blood way like some of the chaps I went to school with, who sought to know what land your family owned in the 1500s, but because it tells you things about yourself that nothing else can. I thought I was the son of Christopher and Lottie Hawthorne. And I knew what that meant. I knew who I was and who I would be. And now I had to figure out the ways in which I was wrong about it all. She gave me my father's name on a Sunday, just as I was loading my car up to go back to London. As I picked up the last bag from the boot room, she came over to me, wrapping her arms around her body as though she was protecting herself from me, and kissed my cheek. "Simon. Simon Artemis," she whispered as she pulled away from me and walked purposefully back towards the kitchen where my sisters were making cakes. I am not au fait with the world of celebrity. Ask me about the Kardashians, and I will proudly tell you that I thought they were a Middle Eastern dynasty until 2 years ago. But I know the world of business, and that name hit me right between the bollocks. The whole drive home, I scoured my brain for every detail I had on him. His parents were bog-standard, comfortable middle class, and proud of their recently attained status. But Simon wanted much more for himself. He had that aggressive business mind from the start. He started a market stall, selling second-hand electronics down his local high street, but moved on to selling vintage clothes in a poncy West London neighbourhood. When he realised the resale value was higher on a grubby old poncho, if you could spin a line about how Jane Birkin might have worn it in the 60s. He bought his first shop aged 19, which he stocked with old tat, bulk bought from flea markets. It didn't look so grubby when modelled on stick-thin mannequins and bathed in cool neon lighting. Buffered by his family's own financial security, Simon ran this mini-empire all while attending university. Much of his self-made image is just that. Image. But it's helped his reputation immensely. Clothing wasn't Simon's main business interest, though. His real money came from investment and property. But the fashion brand kicked it all off. Since then, the Artemis empire had only grown, making him a permanent fixture on the rich list. Simon Artemis was a government advisor on trade and commerce. A token role, really, but it gave him a sheen of respectability that, to be honest, he didn't earn. I don't know how much you know or care about his businesses, but he was a wheeler dealer from the start, and not much changed over the decades. His fashion business worked when so many others failed because he kept a fierce eye on margins and exploited every loophole available to him. He bought Sassy Girl with money from private investors and then paid them back with assets he drew from the business. It didn't cost him a fucking penny. He pivoted to churning out new clothes when he discovered factories in faraway countries where labour laws were non-existent. This changed when there was an outcry over factory conditions in the mid-90s. But he just moved operations to another country, more eager to turn a blind eye and more able to keep journalists and activists at arm's length. Simon employed a team of lawyers and accountants to ensure he paid the minimum UK tax possible. And he kept staff on very dubious contracts, which often ended before he'd have been liable to pay benefits. NDAs were rife at his company. God only knows what they covered. There were at least 8 cases of women dismissed when they got pregnant. And though his representatives were able to successfully argue that there had been legitimate reasons for the firings, everyone knew that the Artemis Company was run by sharks. I don't have a problem with any of this, by the way. I believe that business should regulate itself, and that legislation designed to protect workers exponentially stifles innovation and growth. Tie the hands of a corporation too tightly, and it will have no choice but to move its headquarters somewhere else. A disaster for the UK economy. Simon played within the law, and I don't blame him for exploring the limits of it. I found it hard to accept who my father was for a different reason, and I'm aware that it may paint me in a bit of a bad light to you, Grace. But I'm being totally honest here, and it's not like you can do anything with this, so I have the freedom to be blunt. My main reaction when I found out who my real father was after 23 years was one of enormous embarrassment. Christopher was a man who knew which Wellington boot was just the right shade of green so as not to be flashy. He wore subdued wool suits and would never have countenanced a gold card for fear of looking gauche. I grew up in a family where taste and etiquette were innate, bred into us, never discussed, because we never needed to articulate any of it. But this man was the opposite of everything I understood. I spent a couple of days searching the internet for every bit of information I could find on him, and every single page I clicked on horrified me. Simon owned a fleet of cars with personalised number plates. He wore a ring on his pinky finger with a coat of arms he'd had designed for his family by a jeweller who sold mainly to Russians. There were various hello spreads which showed off the Artemis family home, and the amount of cream and gold on display made me groan out loud. It was all indescribably tacky. It was new money, new furniture, à la vista. Everything I knew I wasn't, without ever having to articulate why. I just couldn't get my head around how Lottie could have been seduced by such a chap. She was weak and young, sure. But Christ, this man was antithetical to everything she'd ever known. It disgusted me, truth be told. My sisters were born into a happy family where convention and tradition meant a lot. I thought that I was too. But instead, I'd landed here after my mother was foolish enough to give herself up for one night with a playboy who holidayed in Marbella and occasionally featured on a TV show about new business ideas called Mogul Wars. Class matters, Grace. I know it's not the done thing to say that, but I think it's utter madness to deny a truth just because it's uncomfortable. I don't know what you thought of Simon's background or his fondness for watches so large they could be a bedside alarm clock, but I imagine you had similar reservations. I don't want to say that it was worse for me, but come on. It was worse for me. I grew up bang slap in the middle of the rigid class system the British skillfully created 1,000 years ago. It's always worse for those of us who are teetering precariously between the categories. At least you knew where you were in the order. I spent a few months bouncing between work and Lottie's house, trying to give my sisters a sense of normality. And if I'm honest, trying to give myself the same. In London, I was progressing in the office and earning a decent whack. But back in Surrey, it became increasingly obvious that Christopher hadn't been quite as comfortable as we'd assumed. His will left everything to Lottie. The house, the car, his investments and pension. But he'd remortgaged without any of us knowing just 3 years ago. And he'd been dipping into his pension to pay the girls' school fees and cover lifestyle expenses. Nothing too fancy. Christopher wasn't a spendthrift. But as I say, our social circle had pretty exacting standards. And Dad was clearly as keen to keep up with the Joneses as anyone. Only in our case, it was the Guinnesses, the Montefiores, the Ascots. Lottie preferred to bury her head in the sand, distracting herself from any immediate issues that her husband's death had thrown up by gardening almost obsessively from dusk until dawn. Every time I tried to broach the subject with her, bulbs would be shoved in my hands or weeds lobbed at my person. Once she walked through a spiky hedge just to get away from the conversation. But I had pored over the numbers, and I knew that we needed a cash injection, and fast. Losing the house would be an indignity that none of us would easily bounce back from. Our family is traditional, and I was now the head of the house. Regardless of modern norms, Lottie couldn't or wouldn't face up to the facts. So I took on the mantle. I'm practical, Grace. I was often berated by my English teacher for lacking the imagination necessary to understand great fiction. I couldn't see the point in most of it myself. If I'm going to read a book, I want it to be an autobiography, sports-focused if possible. And I've never felt it held me back in life. I'm not a dreamer. I know what I want and what I need for a good life, and I'll work my arse off to get it. But I didn't have enough time to secure my family's future while holding a junior position in the city. So I took a different course of action. Can you see what's coming a mile off? I guess it's fairly obvious. I decided that Simon would be our lifeline. The thought first came to me one night in my bedroom as I went over the accountant's notes on the mortgage. The school fees, the running of the house, the outgoings were enormous, and there was no future income large enough to knit it together. Just ask your real father, a voice inside my brain whispered. I almost laughed. Me, contacting that man out of the blue and asking him to fund a family he knew nothing about. Nonsense. And even if I could, I certainly didn't want to get involved with that man. Not from any moral qualms, money is money and he certainly had plenty, but because it was all so tasteless and grubby. A newfound father, a man who was photographed with oligarchs at slightly seedy private members' clubs. A Bentley driver. I dismissed the thought, but it kept coming back. Every time I looked at the finances, his name danced around my mind. Finally, after a slightly harried conversation with the accountant, who explained bluntly that the girls would have to leave their school at the end of the year unless something was done, my resolve crumbled. You don't email a man like Simon Artemis. I've learned that from a few short months in the finance world. People like that are too important. They have 5 assistants, and their inbox is monitored, sieved, messages prioritized and actioned in minutes. Anything I sent would be assigned to the bonkers pile and left well alone. So I turned up at his office. It was a risky move, but I felt the direct approach suited me well. From reading the financial pages every day, I knew that the Artemis Company was eyeing up a smaller clothing company called Rebel, with choice real estate in Soho and Kensington. The ancient owner wasn't budging, insisting that the business would always be a family-run one. I used the name of his son at reception and said I was there to open up a new channel of communication. It could have all gone tits up, but the assistant seemed to know who I professed to be. I suppose Benny Fairstein is a fairly memorable name, if you're in the fashion business, and got on the phone immediately. I only had to wait for 10 minutes before I was shown into Simon's office. His eyes narrowed as I entered, and I knew I only had a moment to explain who I really was. Grace, you're the only other person in the world who I care to share this with. I know you'll find it fascinating, without being interested solely in the gossipy element of it. I was direct. I did not apologize for the false pretenses. I sat down in an armchair across from him and looked him dead in the eye, and I told him that I was his son. Even before I explained further, I have to say he didn't seem very surprised. Perhaps he'd been waiting for a stray child or two to appear. Sensible, if so. I told him about Lottie. I asked him to cast his memory back. I waited. He examined my face with his eyes, and I examined his right back. We alighted upon our identical noses at the same moment. I guess in a film, that moment would have queued up some soaring background music. But we sat in silence. Then he asked what I wanted. Now, in business, there are two ways of approaching this question. You can obfuscate, flatter, and throw up vague and unfinished ideas. Or you go direct. I have no time for the first option. I told him that I had no intention of embarrassing him, that I didn't want to be the long-lost son eager to join his new empire. I respected him, I assured him, but I had a family to support now, and he was the only person who could help me out. I proposed a one-time deal, slid a figure tucked in an envelope across the table, and sat back. He opened it, and he laughed. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but laughter wouldn't have been my top guess. Looking back, I think it impressed him. Maybe he thought it was a power play. It wasn't. I just wanted money, plain and simple. But perhaps the leverage I had was enough to make me bold. The strange thing was, it broke the ice. I guess when you're that rich, you spend your life assuming and suspecting that everyone wants something from you. If a person just confirms that outright, you can move on together. Instead of addressing my request, he stretched back in his chair and pressed the intercom, telling his PA to cancel his next meeting. Then he asked me about my life, where I lived, what I did, which football team I supported. It felt a bit weird initially, but I went along with it. He nodded when I told him about Christopher, and smiled when I said I was working in the city. It turned out that we both supported QPR, and we swapped opinions about the manager for a bit, him ribbing me for missing their last big game. To an outsider, it might have looked like a standard father-son encounter. I kept thinking that. Kept remembering that this man was my dad. This tanned, gym-fit man in a steel-grey suit, who was wearing a gold watch which flicked sunshine into my eyes when he moved his arm. God, I'm boring on, Grace, I'm sorry. But this whole situation has been truly bonkers for me. And I'm not the sort to let it all out to a therapist. Best to crack on, I always think. And I've got very little to complain about, really. A nice family, a good job, financial stability. Ah, yes, I should get to that. Simon gave me the money. It took some wrangling, which was surprisingly good-natured. My initial figure was rejected out of hand, but we eventually settled on a nice six-figure sum to tide Mum over until I was in a more senior position to shoulder the burden. It came on the proviso of a DNA test, which I understood, but still seethed about silently. I felt like Lottie's honour was being called into question. But there's little honour with businessmen like Simon, is there? We both know that. In the 6 weeks it took to negotiate the settlement, I met with Simon a few times, often at his office, but once in a while at a private members' club off Berkeley Square. On one occasion, we went to a match together, eschewing his private box for the stands. I suspect he didn't want to introduce me to his friends, which I understood. How do you introduce your secret son to a bunch of property tycoons who would love to tap that kind of vulnerability while eating food from a buffet you've paid for? QPR 121, and our relationship stepped up a gear. It didn't take a genius to see that Simon enjoyed having a son. I might not have been a son he raised, or even a son he knew very well, but he got a kick out of it anyway. He bantered with me, mocked my blazer, offered to introduce me to his city mates. Sometimes